I am not a cricket in a box. Welcome to my dojo. This is Kung Fu Pizza Party, and I'm your host, Brandon Knight. And today, we're going back to the arcade, folks, as I sit down to review DOA Dead or Alive from 2006. Here on Kung Fu Pizza Party, I seek to deliver high-flying action in 30 minutes or less and serve up some wisdom one slice at a time. All throughout this year, we're going to the arcade. First, to get excited for Mortal Kombat 2, and soon, starting to turn our attention towards Street Fighter with the reboot coming out in October. These summer months have allowed me, though, to experiment and check out some of the other fighting games that have come out over the years that have not produced entire franchises of films, which is certainly the case here today with DOA Dead or Alive. Let's start first with the video game series before transitioning into the film itself, mainly because although this is a very popular, well-established fighting game franchise, for me, I wasn't very familiar with it, and there's a possibility that you, listener, you are not as familiar with DOA, just like I was. I do want to give a little bit of a shout-out, just like I did last month when I reviewed Double Dragon. You can go back and check out my review of that film as well. I did spend some time with one of my favorite YouTubers, well, not literally, I wish, watching a Matt McMuscles video. He has a video series called What Happened. I watched the DOA movie, then I checked out this video to kind of fill in some gaps for me, and I've been doing a good amount of research, and I feel ready to talk about Dead or Alive. So Dead or Alive debuted in arcades back in 1996. It was then ported over to the Sega Saturn in 97, followed by the PlayStation in 98.
Fight.
In all, there are six mainline Dead or Alive games, with the most recent one, Dead or Alive 6, coming out in 2019. However, there was a remake re-release of DOA 6 that came out just last month. Actually, it came out just right about the same time, coincidentally, to when TJ Blackwell was on the show to talk about Ninja Gaiden, a additional series developed also by Team Ninja that does DOA, that is a part of the Dead or Alive universe. The main protagonist of Ninja Gaiden, Ryu Hayabusa, does show up in Dead or Alive at various points. So good on me to kind of get a little bit of a be very timely on accident. Dead or Alive 2 and 3 are considered to be the best games within the franchise, and DOA 2 is actually considered to be one of the greatest fighting games, period, putting it on par with games like Tekken 3, anything but Mortal Kombat 1, and Street Fighter 4. Now, there's one key factor, talking about the contemporaries to DOA, there's one key factor that makes Dead or Alive stand out and distinct from its competitors, and it's the fact that it revolves around a woman, Princess Kasumi. Princess Kasumi is a ninja princess. And don't get me wrong, other fighting game franchises have very strong characters. Like I said a couple months ago, Katana is wonderful in Mortal Kombat 2. She's like the best part of that movie. On the Street Fighter side of things, you have Cammy and Kung Lee. Like, there are strong female characters. Don't get me wrong, not trying to make it that big of a deal about it, but it is really cool to see in what is usually more of a sausage fest, the fighting game franchise, it is cool to see Dead or Alive stand out this way as being a game that is that has a female protagonist at its center, and its roster is predominantly female characters. With that, Dead or Alive, some of you know where this is going, though it is, on the one hand, very inclusive, and maybe it, like I said, stands out among the sausage fest. It's feminist, whatever you may say. The plot of the series is pretty simple. There's not as much lore as, let's say, Mortal Kombat that Joe Day and I spent a combined 2 hours working through. Dead or Alive is a little bit more straightforward, and again, making it a little bit distinct from its competitors, a little bit more grounded. There is some ninja magic and shenanigans, but it's a little bit more tech focus, because Dead or Alive is an annual martial art tournament that brings the best fighters of their styles together to compete against each other for a cash prize. It's being ran by a tech industry giant. Big Tech is running an illegal underground fight club. And I think we all know that is actually more than likely happening in the real world. None of us would be shocked if one day there is a news story that broke that Mark Zuckerberg has been running essentially DOA in his basement while he's smoking meats. Wasn't that going to be a thing at one point, too? Wasn't he going to fight somebody in the Coliseum? Wasn't it going to be like one of the other guys, Elon Musk, Jeff Bezos, and it was going to be live streamed on X or something like that, something ridiculous. The point is, if a tech industry is running a fight club, that's a big red flag as to who the real bad guys are in the story. Now, when you do have a very financially successful franchise, you look for ways to continue to be very financially successful. And so that's where this movie was going to fit in. But there is also a spin-off series to Dead or Alive. And this is the huge irony of having a game that is a more female-led and focused. Famously, or maybe infamously, depending on who you are, Dead or Alive has a very successful spin-off series called Dead or Alive Extreme Volleyball. The plot is essentially this. The tournament is over, so now all the women are going to go take a vacation together and go play some beach volleyball on an island. Here's a very successful, violent fighting game, and now Wii Sports Resort. Like, it's just a little odd, and being from the early 2000s, you can imagine it's pixelated boobies bouncing around like the volleyball is. The thing is, though, I've never gotten to play the extreme volleyball games. That's right, plural. There's multiple of these. But apparently, from virtually everybody I've heard from, it's a good game. They're good games by way of like the volleyball mechanics and how the game works and feels and all of it. DOA Extreme Volleyball is apparently a very good game within that genre as well. So this is like the extreme irony of this franchise, that on the one hand, you can maybe sit back and celebrate it as like, hey, look at this, like representation and inclusivity and all this kind of stuff, while also it's simultaneously clearly trying to have an audience that it's trying to appeal to. It's a very interesting choice, for sure, to, regardless of the sexiness of it, it's a very interesting choice to go from fighting game to beach volleyball game in your spinoff series. It would be like if Call of Duty had a spinoff series instead of Nazi zombies, it was like, I don't know, like a poker game or something. You know what I mean? Just like, wow, we went from shooting bad guys during World War II to where we have a slots game now. All right. But speaking of interesting decisions, let's talk now about the movie focus of today's episode, DOA Dead or Alive from 2006. This movie is very firmly in 2006. This is an early 2000s movie. By the way, I refuse to call it the early aughts, as the kids are calling it nowadays. What does that even mean? That's not, no, it's the early 2000s. Deal with it. I wrote on Letterboxd for my review, which you can follow the show at Kung Fu Pizza, PRTY, that this movie is a Hong Kong action spy thriller with notes of Charlie's Angels, Kill Bill, and GoDaddy commercials. Do you remember the GoDaddy commercials from the early 2000s or the Carl's Jr. Hardee's commercials? Who was that, the swimsuit model that was popular during that time? Kate Upton. That's a person and name I haven't thought of in a long time. It's the movie is a lot of that, okay? It's like the sexiness. I'm going to say that a lot. The sexiness, just like how they say DOA or dead or alive a lot in this movie, or it's written on the screen. They make sure that you know what movie you are watching. Damn it. Anyway, so it's a lot of that, though, just like the sexiness, the allure of the female body. The Kill Bill reference isn't the fact that there's katanas being used, but the fact that there's a lot of feet shots in this movie. Who was the executive producer on this? Tarantino? He wasn't, but I would believe it if he was. Good Lord. That's like a thing, though, I've noticed, weirdly enough, more so because I've been showing producer Cooper children's programming from the early 2000s, late 90s, early 2000s, stuff I would have watched or his mom would have watched. And it's kind of weird how open we were about showing feet back then, retrospectively, especially now where there's a whole online market for that, apparently. It's much like the ancient question of which came first, the chicken or the egg. It also is worth saying which came first, Tarantino or feet fetishes. So yeah, it's a sexy film, but it's still PG-13, so it's just a lot of, like, you know, close-ups of girls in bikinis or suggestive this, that, and the other thing. I was expecting the dialogue to be nothing but innuendos of people wanting to stick their katanas in things, but actually not at all. It is really just like the cinematography, how the movie is shot, what is the shots lingering on. That is the sexiness. But don't let that fool you. The martial arts aspect of this movie is awesome. The fights are really good. And part of that has to do with the director, the martial art movie legend himself, Corey Yuen. For those of you who don't know, Yuen was the fight director on Bruce Lee's Fist of Fury, you know, one of his most iconic movies with some of his most iconic fights in them. He also was the director of Yes, Madam, one of the highest rated, if not the highest rated martial art movie on Rotten Tomatoes, starring Cynthia Rothrock and Michelle Yeoh. He was the director on the first two No Retreat, No Surrenders. He was in, he directed Jet Li's My Father is a Hero. Like, he did a lot of work. And along with having a stellar director at the helm for this movie, the stars of the film, as we'll get to them here in a second, they spent 3 months in training prior to the film, working on wushu, kung fu, and wire work. Yes, this movie has wire work. And I've talked about before, wire work's not necessarily my favorite thing. One thing I've noticed with a movie like this versus other films that do wire work, the thing that usually works for me is when is how the film is shot. I need it to be sexy. I'm just kidding. I need the fight scenes to not just be like a wide shot of people zooming across the screen. I need, if it's done at angles, then it just looks like acrobatics, which is what it's intended to look like. So we got a stellar director at the helm of this movie. We had people in training to do the work, and cast-wise, it's a pretty good group. No one necessarily like, hey, how did Christopher Walken get in this movie? Nothing like, hey, how did Kurt Russell get in here? But it's still a pretty interesting lineup. So let's get into that next. We're going to work through the cast and give you an overview of the plot simultaneously. So, as already established, our main protagonist here is somebody they made up from the movie. Nope, they didn't do that. They did not do that. They also didn't introduce a random magic system that had never existed prior to the franchise either. No, instead we have Princess Kasumi. She is, again, the princess of ninjas in like a Forbidden City kind of environment. Her brother Hayate competed at Dead or Alive the year prior and never returned. However, she knows good and well, no body, no crime. So she has managed to get an invite to this year's DOA and is going to figure out what happened to her brother. However, if she leaves the city, she will be regarded as a shinobi and the leader of the ninja army, whatever, Ayan, she is going to be required to hunt down and kill Kasumi. Luckily, though, she can handle herself, and also, Hayate's best friend, slash guy who has a major crush on Kasumi, which is a total bro code violation. We've all been there, but still, total bro code violation. He also has received an invite to compete at Dead or Alive, and although he's a little bit skeptical of Kasumi's theory that Hayate may still be alive, he is going to go along with her and try and help her figure this out. That best friend being Ryu Hayabusa. Hey, check it out. TJ and I were apparently wrong. We talked about in the Ninja Gaiden episode that there's never been like a movie series anime for Ninja Gaiden, but thankfully, since he is a part of the expanded universe of Dead or Alive, here we go. We do get a physical appearance, and he's one of the main characters for this film, at least. Acting wise, we have Devon Aoki as Kasumi. She was also in movies like Too Fast, Too Furious and Sin City. And playing Hayabusa is Kane Kasugi. Kasugi has had a long career starring in Japanese and American martial art films, and he is the son of Sho Kasugi, who is the man responsible for Ninja Mania in the 1980s, starring in movies like Enter the Ninja and insert title that has the word ninja in it. Like, he's the guy who brought ninjas, you know, made ninjas kind of this like mainstream B movie kind of genre. And lo and behold, his son is going to go on to play one of the most famous ninja characters in a video game series. That's cool. So that's plot A. Plot B then introduces our second female fighter, Tina Armstrong. Tina Armstrong is a professional wrestler, apparently a pretty successful one, seeing how she owns a yacht, but her dream is to win Dead or Alive to prove that she is a legitimate fighter. Her father is concerned about this, and so he sneaks his way into the tournament to try and keep his eye on her. He is also a professional wrestler. And I love when they introduce Tina Armstrong. She's on her yacht and like pirates essentially like hijack the ship to try and like take it over. And the pirate captain is Robin Sho. Hey, look, everybody. Third time this year I've brought up Robin Sho. And get this, won't be the last time. We have one other video game movie to sadly get to. Legend of Kunli. Tina Armstrong is portrayed by Jamie Presley, who was at the time starring as Joy Turner in My Name is Earl. Like, this is going on. The show is like midway through its run when this movie was made. And although her dad, Bass Armstrong, the character is clearly modeled after Hulk Hogan, and he's doing Hogan Knows Best at the time, so I don't know why they couldn't get him for this movie. Instead, though, it's Big Sexy himself, Kevin Nash. I love when Kevin Nash shows up in a movie. I just love Kevin Nash in general. He's a great guy. Met him twice. Ask me about it sometime. I have good stories about meeting Kevin Nash. But he's so chill. He's just such a big, chill dude. You know what I mean? Anyway, finally in our C plot, and yes, all three women are going to end up working together because Charlie's Angels vibes. Finally, we have Christy. Christy is a professional thief, assassin, and hit woman. She does all those things. And so naturally, you can imagine what her motivation is. Let's rob the tournament. That's her plan. Her and her partner, Max, who is just there to womanize. That's it. They are going to rob the tournament. That's plot C. She's played by Holly Valance, who at the time was a big star in Australian soap operas. Cool. She also had a music career. Currently, she spends her time raising money for MAGA. So that's a bummer. She does, however, have one of the most well-shot fight scenes I've ever seen. So we're introduced to her. She had just taken a shower. She's in a towel now, and cops are at her hotel room. They're arresting her for some heist thing, and she's like, well, let me get dressed first. So, you know, sexy, putting on her undies, and then she goes to get her bra, and it turns into this fight scene. And again, PG-13, so you do get, like, a back shot, a little bit of a side boob, but the film is shot in a way that still the towel and her bra are used to censor the remainder of her boobs, which it's done really well. It's not campy like in Austin Powers when he's holding, or when the woman is holding like the cantaloupes, or he's got the pineapple in the, you remember that bit? Like, it's not that. It's like genuinely angled so that way she is concealed, but still using her environment as a weapon. It's genuine. It's laughable, but also like just a touch impressive at the same time. Now, spoilers for a 20-year-old film, hashtag release the Paul W.S. Anderson cut. Fun fact, he was actually slated to direct this movie first, but backed out because he had a Death Race and Resident Evil something, I don't know, one of the 82 Resident Evil films. So Hayate is alive, and the big tech industry has created essentially meta glasses that harnesses the abilities of the fighters and gives the wearer their fighting ability. That's not how physiology works, but anytime that kind of thing shows up. But so they all together, including Ayn, who's so happy because she had a crush on Hayate. I'm almost out of time here. They're all super excited, save the day. By the way, the main bad guy, his name's Donovan. That was apparently a creative change that was made from the game series. But his scientist lackey, who eventually joins the good guys, Weatherby, he's played by Steve Howey. You know, Vance from Reba. He goes from being a super jock in Reba to just being this total nerd who can't talk to any of the sexy women on this island. Speaking of women on an island, yeah, there's a volleyball scene in this movie. You didn't think they were going to get through this without there being a volleyball scene, did you? Also, simultaneously to the volleyball scene, there is a stealth mission that Hayabusa goes on. So you get a little bit of everything. You get some volleyball. You get some ninja stealth stuff. You get a lot of good wire work and some like recognizable people throughout this movie. So why is it that I have no recollection of this movie ever existing? And that goes back to the decisions that were made about the movie. The movie itself is fine. It's pretty good. I think the Rotten Tomatoes 30-something percent that it has is actually like not even remotely doing this film justice. Like, it's a worth, if you can get past, or if you want the nostalgia, either way, of the fact that it's very firmly a 2000s action movie, like, it's a pretty enjoyable ride. I think the biggest critique I have is that it's just under 90 minutes, and it actually probably could have used like 20-30 more minutes just to kind of flesh out a few things. There were some parts where I feel like we're kind of just skipping around here a little bit, or they never like fully foreshadow exactly what the bad guys are doing. It's just out of nowhere. Now I have meta Ray-Bans that give me superpowers. So then why did DOA, Dead or Alive, only gross $7 million off of a $30 million budget? Bad decisions on distribution. they didn't line anybody up to distribute the movie before it was made, so it just sat around for a while. Thankfully, the Weinstein Company, which is a sentence nobody has ever said before in their life, picked it up, but then they blundered everything up again by doing an international release for a whole year before it came to the States. So this movie didn't even hit stateside until 2007. Then at Comic-Con, it was supposed to get, San Diego, was supposed to get this big panel, you know, screening, all this, pulled the plug on that. Dimension Films pulled the plug on that for unforeseen reasons, and instead did no press screenings, only shipped the movie to 500 theaters, which makes it technically a limited release, and then got pulled from those 500 theaters 3 weeks later. If Dimensions would have actually put some effort into it, could DOA have been a financial success? The production team sure does think it would have been a financial success. $6 of the $7 million came from international audience, so even within the limited run that it had, it still did okay for itself. So would I watch DOA Dead or Alive again? Actually, I would. Like I said, if you can get past the 2000s-ness of it, I think it's actually, I was surprised how much I enjoyed this film for what it is. I don't think it is it's so bad, it's good. It's not a hidden gem. It might be a movie that's slept on, and you could very easily get your hands on it. It's, you know, Pluto TV, it's on all of them. Pluto TV, Fossum, Roku, I watched it on Tubi. Would I own a physical media copy of it? I'd own a poster of it, that's for sure. Am I right, fellas? And some of the ladies, am I right? No, but seriously, like, would I own a physical media copy of it? Maybe. I think if I could definitely see me trying to track it down if I was, gonna, like, see one of these people at a Comic-Con. Not Holly Valance or whatever her name is, not her. But raise your MAGA money somewhere else. MAGA and the Weinsteins, all in the same episode. Aren't you so happy you tuned in? I got to get out of here. Thanks for listening to today's episode. If you haven't yet already, please rate and review the show wherever you get your podcasts. Pass this episode along to a friend. And check out the other shows here on the Ands Out Podcast Network. Follow the show on Instagram at Kung Fu Pizza Party. And my YouTube channel, Studio 219. This has been Kung Fu Pizza Party, where I've delivered high-flying action in 30 minutes or less and served with some wisdom one slice at a time.